start a new recording with Copernicus. So I bring you source number 9, because this is really remarkable. In case you thought the debate about whether the Earth goes around the Sun or the Sun goes around the Earth ended in the 16th century, well, you know it didn't end in the 16th century because even the secular world did not adopt Copernicus' findings right away for reasons that we'll come back to. But take a look at this piece. Writer is Jeremy Brown, who's written on the issue of Copernicus and the reaction to him in several places. But this is an article called Rabbi Reuven Landau and the Jewish Reaction to Copernican Thought. In the opening years of this century, when he says this century, he means the 21st. Rabbi Shlomo ben Isri, once Israel's Minister of Labor and Social Affairs, published a comprehensive textbook on the Jewish calendar titled Hashamayim Misaparim. In English, it means the heavens proclaim. Most of Rabbi ben Isri's work covers the complex mathematical and astronomical foundations which determine the structure of the lunar-based Jewish calendar, and the last part of the book describes the nature of the solar system. In this last section, Rabbi ben Isri concludes that despite nearly 500 years of scientific and astronomical evidence to the contrary, it is the sun that revolves around the earth, not vice versa. Although Rabbi ben Isri was educated in traditional Orthodox yeshivot and never attended university, his book made use of many modern scientific instruments and discoveries. It reproduced high-resolution telescopic images of the surface of the planets, including those sent from the famous Viking 1 project, and described the composition of the atmosphere and surface of the planets using data from NASA's solar explorations. And yet, after a lengthy analysis, Rabbi ben Isri stated that the Earth does not orbit the sun. Because in his account, the Bible, the rabbis of the Talmud, and their medieval commentators had all concluded that the earth lay at the center of the universe. 21st century. Wow. Okay, so what we need to do is figure out what in the world happened here. So in order to do that, a little bit of explanation regarding Copernicus himself. Copernicus was born in the year 1473 in Poland. He studied math and astronomy, among various subjects, and he offered a suggestion to change the standard model, which is attributed to Ptolemy, the Ptolemaic model of the way the solar system works. He was not the first to suggest this. He was aware that there were Greeks who had suggested this as well, but it had never been taken seriously. He was dealing with several problems with the Ptolemaic model. One of the classic problems is called the problem of retrograde motion. If you accept the idea that all of these planets are revolving around the Earth, and the Sun is revolving around the Earth, then you run into problems with the fact that as we observe the movement of the Earth, and if you can imagine the Sun is here and the Earth is here, and let's say Mars is over here, as Earth is making its orbit around the Sun, Mars falls behind in ways that it shouldn't if it's actually revolving around the Earth. Now, this wasn't Copernicus's discovery. Everyone had known about retrograde motion. You looked up in the sky, not today when we have light pollution and we don't really look up into the sky, but back when people actually cared what was going on up there, you could see where the planets were, and you could observe the fact that it didn't fit the Ptolemaic model, and they came up with all sorts of really innovative solutions for the problem. Innovations like what's called epicycles. The idea that the planets are not actually simply going around in an orbit, but they're going like this, and like this, and they're sort of curving around like that. If you can see them on the recording, if you can see them, my finger is spinning. They came up with all sorts of fascinating ideas to try to make this work. Copernicus finds an easier way to deal with the problems with the heliocentric model. The idea that, in fact, all these planets are actually going around the sun. Now, his model was not perfect. Among other problems, he believed that the planets had a circular orbit around the sun. And it was only later they'd realize it's actually an ellipse. It's not a circle, and that explains some of the problems that he had. He develops the theory relatively early on in life, but it's not clear when he starts teaching it, because it's a very controversial idea, because everyone thinks we're the center of everything. I believe I'm the center of everything. So what do you mean we're going around the sun? And so he doesn't promote it. He only publishes his major work on the topic in the year of his death, 1543, which means he's not around to defend it.
But he had a problem with the church. They didn't want him to.
So the church actually isn't involved so much in terms of Copernicus because he hasn't published it.
No, but I meant he knew the church would.
Yeah, he knew they wouldn't like it. But what happens is this isn't really accepted until the 17th century when Galileo makes his observations which support Copernicus. And Galileo was the one who gets into real trouble with the church. But the things that he's seeing, you know, just... It's so clear that this model is what explains the observations, where the old Ptolemaic model is simply not working. There's another fellow named Tycho Brahe, who we'll have to come back to, who comes up with another solution for this, a sort of a hybrid of the Ptolemaic model with Copernicus. Okay, so from the Jewish perspective, there are problems with what Copernicus is suggesting. I go back to what I had said before we started the class today. We were talking about that article about Joshua stopping the sun. I brought you the verse here in source number 10. This is in that war that they're fighting to defend Gibeon. And this is the verse. And he, Joshua, spoke before the eyes of Israel at source number 10. Sun in Gibeon, be silent or be still. You could translate the word dome either way. And moon in the valley of Ayalon. He wants the sun and the moon to halt. This was usually understood to mean the sun is going around the earth, the moon is going around the earth, and we want them to stop where they are. Now, obviously, this creates other problems besides the astronomical question of who is circling whom, right? I mean, in terms of the way gravity works, in terms of the way our planet survives. In the event that you actually halt the relative motion of the sun and the moon, you're going to have bigger problems than whether Copernicus was right. Nonetheless, that's the way the story is told here, and was classically understood to mean the sun is going around the earth and it's going to stop. Similarly, source number 11, later in Jewish history, less well known because Joshua gets learned in the schools, you know, by school children. Isaiah, not so much. But you get Isaiah presenting a sign. He says, and this is your sign from God, that God will do that which he has said. God made a promise, he's going to fulfill it, and here is your sign that he's going to do it. I will return the shade of the degrees, meaning, if you can imagine a sundial, right, showing the position of the sun in the sky. I'm going to return the shade of the degrees which have descended on the degrees of Ahaz, the sundial of his, by the sun, 10 degrees backward. He says the sun is going to go up 10 degrees in the sky. And the sun retreated 10 degrees, which again is classically understood to mean that the sun is going around the earth and now it's going to retreat along its path. Another verse, Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, popular verse. Dor olech v'dor ba, generation goes, a generation comes, v'haaretz le'olam omadet, and the earth stands forever. The idea being, the earth stands. It doesn't move. Everything else is moving. We are in place. Sue, what are you going to say?
Just an interesting way of reading it.
Yeah, for sure. Do these verses bother you in terms of whether the sun is going around the earth or the earth around the sun? Does this cause you to think Copernicus must not be right because look at these verses, or the Torah must be wrong because, you know, the earth goes around the sun? I read these verses, yeah.
I think they dealt with the fact that they saw them and they had no way of visualizing. How it might be different.
Or I'll go even stronger. Linda says, you know, it just reflected what you observed, right? Without knowing what was really going on out in space. But I would go even further and say they didn't care. This wasn't about scientific reality. This was just, it looks to me like the Earth stands forever. And if you will tell me that it's not, I don't care. Look, I believe that Copernicus is correct. Nonetheless, I use terms like sunrise and sunset. Right? The sun never rose. The sun never set. It's the earth that's the one who's doing the rising and setting. But that's what we say. Yes?
When I read the
the earth stands forever, maybe in the Hebrew it's different. To me, it just means generations come and go. People come and go on the physical earth. But the earth, as it is in nature, is there.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't just change, but it doesn't mean it doesn't move.
Right. And that's what it means in the Hebrew, too. That's what it means in the Hebrew as well. You don't really have to position these as, Copernicus can't be right because now I can't believe in this story. You know, like I said, the problems of the sun stopping or the earth stopping relative to the sun are much bigger than whether Copernicus is right. This doesn't have to shake anyone's faith in the biblical text or in Copernicus's discovery. But boy, they responded in his day, not among the Jews, among the Christians. They said, you're disagreeing with the Bible. It cannot be. And they quoted other verses like these to support the idea that he must be wrong. They quoted a verse in Psalms, which describes the sun going from the east to the west, Mizrach Shemesh Ad Mevo'o, from the east of the sun to the place where it sets. Again, that's what I see. It's not, you know, it's not a description of which one is moving and which one is standing still.
So, how do you, when someone comes to you with new science?
Yeah.
They've now found a new planet that they don't.
Yeah.
Okay, so. How do you explain this to children, that you're told this, but it's really the science is this?
So that's where we have to go with this. I'm taking my time getting there. But that's where we have to go with this. In other words, we need to...
You should have Donald Trump at the table, because science...
Do me a favor. I got through how many minutes without him?
This is important.
Yeah.
And then how do we tell our kids,
right,
when
well,
they see the new science, that that's not really...
Right. So one point, which again, we're going to see in greater detail as we go through this, but one point is recognizing that the way you understood a verse yesterday isn't necessarily the only way to read it. And even if I read a verse, I'm not talking about saying the verse yesterday looked like it said this is prohibited and now I think it's permitted. I'm not talking about a diametrically opposite read. But reading a verse that says the earth stands forever, which yesterday I thought meant the earth is static. And today I understand, no, it means the earth is permanent. It means that human beings are temporary and the earth is here. And then you're going to tell me, well, actually the earth is going to be burned up in the sun in X number of billions of years. And I'm going to say that's okay because human beings won't be there anymore. I mean, it's not... It means that your understanding of the biblical text should not be anchored in a particular philosophy of a particular era. That's going to be the key to this, but we're going to see it play out this week and next on, in terms of particular challenges. So we're not done. We're not close to done. But this was one area, one cause for challenge. Another cause for challenge was basic philosophy. Again, the issue of adopting scientific hypothesis over divine revelation. I think the text says this, but in fact, the science says that. But part of this was also a major philosophical issue called anthropocentrism. And this is really, I think, the key to understanding what's going on in the opposition to Copernicus. The question fundamentally is this. Are human beings the focus of the universe? Are we the reason why God created the world? That's really what this discussion is about. Is it all about us? Right, I don't know yet. Okay, maybe. So if you take a look, I'm actually going to jump to 14 and then back to 13, because I like 14 more for this to begin with. Rabbi Sadia Gaon, leader of the Jews, in many ways, of world Jewry, in 10th century Baghdad, talks about the idea that the middle is the most important of anything you're dealing with. He says, customary practice and construction place the most honored element in the center of the elements that are not as honored. We will begin from the smallest things and note that a grain kernel is in the middle of all of the leaves. What's important is the kernel, but it's surrounded by everything else. And then he gives other examples and he says, and as we see this apply to most things, and I have seen that the earth is in the center of the heavens with the spheres revolving about it on all sides, this validates for us that the earth is the goal of creation. We are in the middle. We then look at all the earth's elements and see that the dirt and water are silent. The animals cannot communicate, meaning communicate abstract thought. And all that remains is man. We must be it. Because we're on the earth, and the earth is in the middle, and can't be anything else on earth that matters. It's not that the universe was created for the dolphins. The earth was created for us. So argues Rabbi Sadia Gaon, and he is far from the only one. However, Maimonides disagreed. Maimonides said, we are not the be-all and end-all. We who believe, go back to number 13 now. He says, we who believe in the creation must admit that God could have created the universe in a different manner as regards the causes and effects contained in it. And this would lead to the absurd conclusion that everything except man existed without any purpose. As the principal object, man could have been brought into existence without the rest of the creation. I need to explain the translation, because the translation is not my own, and I don't think he did a great job with it. I just used this translation because it could be cut and pasted, but I should have really done my own on it. What Maimonides says is that God could have created the universe in any way in which he chose. Well, that means that God could have created human beings alone. He didn't need to create our support system, the food chain, the environment. If God wanted just human beings, he didn't need everything else.
How would we live?
Whatever he wanted to create us as. He would create us not needing to eat. He would create us not needing to sleep. He would create us not needing all these other things. He said, Maimonides' point is, God could have created us and just us. And if he brought everything else into existence, it must be that those other things have a function in their own right. And it's not about us. And so he says, I consider therefore the following opinion as most correct according to the teaching of the Bible, and best in accordance with the results of philosophy. Namely, the universe does not exist for man's sake. Each being exists for its own sake and not because of some other thing. There are African tree frogs because there are African tree frogs, not because human beings need them. There are icebergs because there are icebergs, not because human beings need them. Everything that exists has its own function and its own existence and its own meaning. And it's not all about us. That's the way Maimonides looks at the universe. But the truth of the matter is that his is a minority view, historically. People tended to believe that human beings are the center, teleologically, in terms of the purpose of everything. And when Copernicus comes along and says, actually, we revolve around something else, boy, is that agitating and aggravating to the rest of the philosophical world, and certainly the Jewish world. We saw that reflected in a thought we saw last time from our Moshe Sofer, in which he said, well, of course Copernicus thinks that the world revolves around the sun, because he thinks the sun and the stars are important and nothing on earth matters. But we believe that what we do is significant, and therefore we understand why everything should revolve around us. It's a basic philosophical thing that Copernicus is making a statement that we aren't the purpose of the universe. And that is what agitates people. It's not only about biblical verses that you could read one way or another. It's the philosophical problem of what is the focus of the universe. Is it us or is it something else? You follow? So what we've seen in the Copernicus discussion, separate from the whole first half where we talked about the cow that wouldn't die, where we learned a separate lesson, the lesson about sometimes the Torah isn't about the science at all. It's making a statement for a matter of practical convenience, like the list of trefot, potentially. What we see here in the discussion about Copernicus is that here you had a case in which the science was upsetting, not only because it challenged our understanding of what the Torah is saying, but because it challenged our understanding of ourselves. Who are we? And you can transplant this to other modern scientific discoveries. Right? The more science discovers about the traits of a human being dependent on biology, things that are based on hormones, things that are based on genes. We can find a gene that makes people risk takers. We can find that people get angry because of an imbalance in their bloodstream. Right? Things that people traditionally thought of as being about their personality or their soul. That challenges the way people look at the world. And there will be people who will reject it and say, well, this contradicts my religious point of view. So what we're going to have to do next time, because we're at 11 and I don't want to hold people late, But what I want to be able to discuss is the meaning that this has, and then the reactions that were seen in the Jewish world to Copernicus, how we dealt with this kind of philosophical upheaval. So we'll continue with that, God willing, next time. If you're not yet on the email list, please make sure to see me so that I can...